Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, 1 year later, nearly a third of the trash has yet to be picked up. Less than half of the city's pre-storm population of 460,000 has returned, putting the population at roughly what it was in 1880. We're talking of New Orleans, of course. 60% of homes still lack electricity. 17% of the buses are operational. Half the doctors have left. There's a shortage of 1,000 nurses. Only six of the nine hospitals remain closed. 66% of public schools have reopened. A 40% hike in rental rates, disproportionately affecting black and low-income families, is in effect. And there's been a 300% increase in the suicide rate. Dan Gaynor is with us from the Conservative Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. And Dan, you would submit, I'm guessing, that the reason for these disasters after the disaster is that government has been handling this reconstruction of New Orleans rather than private corporations.
No, I don't think I would say that. I think certainly the reconstruction has been, just as the event was mishandled wildly on a local and state level, before it even ever got to the federal government, I think the reconstruction is being mishandled. I believe the mayor has not delivered on a redevelopment plan even now. And so government, but in our society, in any society, it would be unfair to characterize conservatives and saying we don't think there's a need for government in some things. And it's a disaster. Of course there's a need for government to be involved in the planning and trying to re-energize an entire city, an entire region even.
So where do we draw the lines, Dan?
Oh, well, you and I could spend a couple years dividing that up, or locally.
Well, let's do about 6 minutes on it.
I was going to say, locally, though, I think they can determine, you naturally, you need businesses involved in this, because we saw after Hurricane Katrina, businesses were the first people on the scene effectively. Businesses and church groups were some of the most able to respond. So if you're going to rebuild, you have to take that into account. If you don't have jobs for people, you don't have a renovation of a whole city.
Well, you could have the government hiring people. I mean, if we look at Hurricane France, let's look at two hurricanes that preceded Katrina. Hurricane Francis hit Florida, and I'm reading from the FEMA website. Okay, 1 day after the hurricane left, this was as of noon Monday. I'm quoting from the FEMA website. In response to Hurricane Francis, FEMA and other federal responsive agencies have taken the following actions. About 100 trucks of water and 280 trucks of ice are present or will arrive at the Jacksonville staging area today. 900,000 meals ready to eat are on site in Jacksonville, ready to be distributed. Over 7,000 cases of food, including vegetables, fruits, cheese, ham, and turkey, are scheduled to arrive in Winter Haven today. Disaster medical assistance teams, DMATs, are on the ground and setting up comfort stations. FEMA community relations personnel will coordinate with DMATs to assist victims. Urban search and rescue teams are completing reconnaissance missions in coordination with state officials. FEMA is coordinating with the Department of Energy in the state to ensure that necessary fuel supplies will be distributed, with a special focus on hospitals and emergency facilities. The Army Corps of Engineers will soon begin its efforts to provide tarps to tens of thousands of owners of homes and buildings that have seen damage to their roof. The National Guard has called up 4,100 troops in Florida, as well as thousands in nearby states, to assist in the distribution of supplies and in preparation for flooding. The Department of Health and Human Services, Veterans Affairs, and Defense together have organized 300 medical personnel who are on standby. Medical personnel begin deployment to Florida tomorrow. FEMA is coordinating public information messages with Georgia, Tennessee, Alabama, North Carolina, so that evacuees from Florida can be informed when it's safe to return. Now, this is Hurricane Francis, in addition to federal personnel already in place for Hurricane Charlie, which has preceded this. Now, with Hurricane Charlie, which hit, you know, just a little bit before that, they had, the federal government, the Bush administration, had succeeded. Now, this was all in the months leading up to the election of 2004, you'll keep in mind. And this was all in the red state of Florida. And in the case of Hurricane Charlie, which was a pretty hard hit, it killed quite a few people, the Bush administration had succeeded in, and this, again, reading from the White House website, registering approximately 136,000 assistance applications, approving within 1 week over 13,500 applications for more than $59 million in housing assistance, establishing 12 disaster recovery centers, which have already assisted nearly 19,000 disaster victims, deploying medical teams that have seen nearly 3,000 patients, dispersing 1.2 million liters of water, 8.1 million pounds of ice, and 2 million meals and snacks, delivering over 20,000 rolls of plastic sheeting and 170 generators, treating more than 2,900 individuals through FEMA disaster medical assistance teams. Now, all of that was done for two hurricanes in Florida, in Jeb Bush's state. None of that was done. In fact, when New Orleans was drowning, George Bush went out and ate cake with John McCain, and then the next day went out to California and played guitar with a rock star.
If you were paying attention when you were reading, going down that list, one of the key points here, and it really is missing in Katrina in New Orleans, and missing less in Biloxi in Mississippi in general, is the local component. Several times during those fairly lengthy lists, you ran in and said, coordinated with state people, coordinated with local people, delivered this.
The first official to declare a state of emergency when Katrina was heading towards the Atlantic coast, the Gulf Coast, the first official was Governor Blanco of Louisiana. The first official. 3 days before the hurricane hit landfall, she was the first to declare a state of emergency, request federal aid. She was assured by Michael Brown that over 800 buses were going to come down to New Orleans to take people out, and was told not to move those buses that Matt Drudge had on his homepage for a week, making it look like she had screwed up somehow.
Well, I would say people have screwed up and down the line on Katrina.
It's looking to me like a Democrat, the counties, you know, FEMA took out of its disaster plan after the governor declared a state of disaster. FEMA took out of its disaster plan five counties in Louisiana, including the New Orleans area, that had voted for John Kerry. I mean, it's looking to me like this is political punishment.
I disagree completely on that. I think what you're assuming, because even the way it's played out as far as the reconstruction, Mississippi has been better prepared. The local people were better prepared. Florida, I mean, the irony here is you're almost busting on Bush for doing too good of a job in Florida. If you want to say that across the board, state, local, national officials did a lousy job with both preventing Katrina and responding to it, you won't get any disagreement from me, or I don't think any conservative I've ever met. But again, all politics is local. That's a Tip O'Neill quote. You start at the local and work up. That's the way our system is. And so the local people had a lot of things in place. Part of it is, Florida gets hit by hurricanes a lot. New Orleans, for all that this was the big one, perhaps they were less prepared. They clearly were less prepared locally for what happened. And Florida was well prepared. So when FEMA was coordinating with them, and the same guy who gets busted on for how he responded on Katrina was the guy who was doing all those wonderful things you were just listening in.
Doing them in the critical red state of Florida in the months before the 2004 election.
But you don't find that odd? I think you're conflating politics with response to emergency. One, the scope of Katrina was beyond that which I think anybody, local, state, or national, really quickly was aware of.
No, George Bush was briefed 4 days by the head of the National Hurricane Center 4 days before the thing hit. He was briefed, and we've now, a year later, seen the videotape of it, his being told that the levees could be breached, which means the city could be flooded. He knew this was coming. He lied about it afterwards, but he knew this was coming.
Could be. Doesn't mean, you know.
Well, he could be. Well, I saw it on TV. I saw him being briefed, and so did the rest of America.
What you saw on TV, as I recall, was that, the levees are being topped. There's a difference.
No, I'm talking about when he, perhaps you missed it. I mean, it didn't get a lot of media coverage. This was about 4 months ago, 3 or 4 months ago. They finally released the tapes of the video conference where Bush is sitting in the White House and he's watching a big screen monitor where he's having a video conference with Max Mayfield, the head of the Hurricane Center or whatever it is, whatever it's called. And Mayfield is saying, we're expecting there's a possibility that this hurricane could breach the levees. And Bush is going, okay, we'll do something. We'll be ready for that.
Yeah, again,
and he wasn't. He was.
You're talking about a possibility. I'm talking about after the fact. I mean, the after the fact.
Well, the possibility in Florida, they prepositioned 7,000 cases of food for Hurricane Francis. They prepositioned 100 trucks of water, 280 trucks of ice for Hurricane Francis. Prepositioned.
Yeah, but the possibility, you know, you're, I, like I said,
nothing was prepositioned for this.
If you're going to, I said, if you're going to talk about was, I mean, how many years did her, did New Orleans have to prepare for this, when they got blasted? Was it in the 60s? It was the hurricane. I can't remember the name of the hurricane. But that was so devastating to them. They had 40 years to prepare locally. When you go back to,
there's
Oakland,
no way locally you can prepare for your entire city being wiped out. You can't have cops show up on the scene when their homes are in, underwater.
But you can prepare for it eventually. You look back to the earthquakes out in California after the big earthquake. People were better prepared for the next big earthquake.
So then the federal government should have just told Florida to screw off in 2004?
No, I think you coordinate with, I mean, you coordinate with the federal government. So like I said, I fault everybody up and down the line. I have no problem doing that.
Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's scary because I've only got like $80 to my name, my job and my bank and everything like that is all in New Orleans.
It's very sad that the hurricane tore up the Gulf Coast. But people there are poor and poor folks aren't the ones that we help most. You lived on the edge till the day the hurricane blew you away, and now you do have to live like a refugee.
And with all the standing water, it's just not healthy to be in the city. There are bodies floating in there. There's fecal matter floating in the water, and there's a serious disease situation developing. And so even though nobody knows where these people are going to go, the mayor says they have to leave now.
You're looking for someone to help you out in a disaster. Well, Bush's cronies won't be getting help to you any faster.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
Orleans in ruins in Katrina's way. Bush rides his bike, plays a guitar, and eats cake, and says you do have to live like a refugee.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Yeah, you got to live like a refugee in Bush world. This is an amazing thing. United Press International, UPI, sent out a wire service story referencing a comment that former FEMA director Michael Brown made on ABC News' program This Week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, standing by comments that he made that are in Playboy magazine. UPI sent this out to all the media in the United States. Every newspaper in the country could have picked this story up. And yet, if you go over to BuzzFlash.com, you'll find that the link to it is at DailyIndia.com. A newspaper in India picked it up, but American papers are not picking it up. What is the story that no U.S. paper wants to pick up from a national wire service? Well, here it is. The headline says, Brown says White House wanted him to lie. The article reads, and it's a relatively short article, I'll just read it straight up. The ousted head of the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency says the White House wanted him to lie about the response to Hurricane Katrina. Former Director Michael Brown told ABC News' This Week with George Stephanopoulos Sunday he stood by comments in a Playboy interview, and President Bush wanted him to take the heat for the bungling. Brown said, the lie was that we were ready and that everything was working as a team. Behind the scenes, it wasn't working at all. There were political considerations going in all the discussions. There was the fact that New Orleans did not evacuate and that Mayor Ray Nagin had no plan. End of quote. Brown said it was natural to, quote, want to put the spin on the things that are working the way they're supposed to. And behind the scenes, they're not. Again, my biggest mistake was not leveling with the American public and saying, folks, this isn't working. The former FEMA chief cited what he called an email from, quote, a very high source in the White House that says the president at a cabinet meeting said, thank goodness Brown's taking all the heat because it's better that he takes the heat than I do, end quote. Also on this week, U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat from Louisiana, said the administration still doesn't understand the magnitude of the reconstruction problem, but the president's golf course coast coordinator, Don Powell, said the federal government's number one priority is to rebuild the area in a business-like way. In a business-like way. What does that mean? A business-like way? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay.
Hey, Tom. You said before that you agree with Robert Byrd that the authorization for the Iraq War was unconstitutional. So, you know, if a parent gives a child a gun and that child kills someone, the parent is legally liable. So how come Congress isn't legally liable if Bush gets held for tried for war crimes?
Well, because we're not talking about parents and children here. If I give you a gun and you go out and kill someone, I'm not legally liable.
Yeah, but Congress, as you said, it was unconstitutional and illegal for them to authorize the war because the founding fathers felt no one man should ever have the authority to declare war.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jay. I think we'd have to go back, and we did this a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago on this program, and it's been that long since I've read the actual authorization that was given to George W. Bush, and so I'm speaking from an admittedly bad memory, but my recollection is that that authorization that they gave to that Congress gave to Bush said that he had to certify in writing to Congress before he commenced hostilities that he was doing it because there was an imminent threat to the United States and that it had something to do with 9/11.
No,
Bush did do that. He did write a letter in which he said to Congress that Iraq represented an imminent threat and that it was tied to 9/11, both of which were lies and Bush knew it. So I would submit to you that Bush should be held accountable for perjury.
Of course, but how come Kerry and Gephardt were always claiming that Bush didn't come back to Congress like he said he would?
I beg your pardon? Why are they not saying that?
No, Kerry and Gephardt often complained. They said, but Bush said he would come back to Congress. That was part of the deal, and they never came back. So why are those two claiming he didn't come back?
I think that their assumption at the time the law was passed was that Bush would come before Congress and make the argument, and instead he simply sent them a letter, which I believe satisfied the law itself. It didn't satisfy the senators. So, and let's keep in mind, by the way, that the majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against the authorization for the use of force in Iraq. And yes, a majority of the Democrats in the Senate voted for it. A lot of them are now pulling back and saying, oops, shouldn't have done that. I mean, you got John Edwards has apologized. A number of them have come out and said, shouldn't have done that. And good on it. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes. We're seeing things in a different way. God knows it ain't his. It sure ain't no surprise.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, I have a piece up on commondreams.org right now, reclaiming the issues, Islamic or Republican fascism? And we'll get into that a little later on in the program as we go along. But really, the bottom line here is you can't govern if you don't believe in government. And ever since Ronald Reagan declared war against government itself, against democracy itself, against the idea of people organizing themselves as a community, locally, countywide, statewide, nationally, people organizing themselves as a community to provide some protections for themselves from corporate predators, from natural disasters. Ever since Ronald Reagan declared war against democracy, we've had a steady erosion of the ability of government to function in a way that is positive and progressive and useful. Here's Reagan's declaration of war.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And see, it's increasingly we're coming back from that. But we had a period of about 20, 25 years there where America just fell asleep. Just got stoned out. I mean, we got a contact high from Limbaugh and all his OxyContin. and just started believing, oh, yeah, gee, government can't do anything right. You know, it's just there's no reason to have government. Why don't we just, you know, charter schools? Yeah, let's just outsource our schools. And now we see the study, charter schools don't perform as well as public schools. Oh, well, you know, all the problems are because of unions. And, well, we find people who are unionized have better, you know, better lives. They're the middle class. They're stimulating the economy. Well, you know, it's we got to do away with these pensions and have 401k. Now we're seeing an increase in poverty. We're seeing an increase in elderly poverty. Down in the New Orleans area, we're seeing a 300% increase in suicides. I mean, this is a disaster. And it's a disaster because of Reaganism, Bushism, because of the conservative political philosophy. Really, nothing more or less. They view government as something to use to advance their own interests, to seize money and to seize power, which is what they're doing on a regular and on an ongoing basis. And so, you know, when you have a disaster in Florida, hey, it's an opportunity to seize power. So they perform very, very well. When you have a disaster in New Orleans, hey, it's a disaster to punish Democrats. So they perform very poorly. And then afterwards, Reconstruction needs to happen. Hey, it's an opportunity to make some money. So they send in their big, you know, the Halliburton, their cronies, Halliburton and Blackwater and Bechtel, and we can make some money off this thing. But it's not about getting the job done. It's not about serving the people. 1-866-440-THOM, our phone number, 440-8466. Susan in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. I was just wondering if you had seen or heard the interview President Bush did with the ABC affiliate in Biloxi last Thursday, I think it was.
I did not.
Well, I sent you a transcript. I emailed the transcript to you. In this interview, he told the reporter that the reason Mississippi did better, made out better, with getting relief than Louisiana did is because of his very good relationship with Haley Barbour. And
Trent Lott.
And he also said that, he says here, it helps that we're friends, and it also helps that you've got Trent Lott and Thad Cochran as your U.S. senators.
In other words, Mississippi got helped out because it's a Republican state, and
exactly.
Louisiana got screwed because it's a Democratic state.
Exactly. I mean, he out and out admitted it.
And why wasn't that a national headline?
Good question.
Yeah. Yeah. It's because our corporate media is as Republican as Bush is. I mean, it was a rhetorical question, but
I
think it's increasingly evident. Susan, thank you
Absolutely.
For the call.
Absolutely. Okay, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah. Good talking with you. John in Glendora, California. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you. Yesterday I was watching Free Speech TV. They got a show called Democracy Now.
Yeah, Amy Goodman. Amy's a friend.
Yes. They had a freelance reporter. He had gone out to New Orleans, I guess, a week or so before and interviewed some of the people, and he had found out through interviewing these people that the federal government had paid a company called Emergency Management, I can't remember if it was Industries or Incorporated, and what they were supposed to do was to come up with a plan to not only evacuate New Orleans, but to also get relief in there and distribute the funds.
Right.
And when he tried to go in and interview these people, they would not interview with him, and they, in fact, had him thrown out by guards, and they had already received their money. So I don't know how many millions or billions of dollars they received from the government, but they already received it and are not being held accountable for anything.
Yeah. This is the cronyism. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling. You look back at the Warren G. Harding administration, and his Secretary of Agriculture, or Secretary of the Interior, actually, was Albert Fell was his name. Let some friends of his, gave leased some lands that the Navy controlled out in Wyoming, oddly enough, you know, Dick Cheney's home state, called the Teapot Dome area, leased some of these lands to some crony, some friends of his, and he got a couple $100,000 out of the deal. I mean, you know, ultimately,
wow.
Basically, you could call it a bribe, but he got it in a way that today would be not all that different, frankly, in my opinion, from the way that Dick Cheney is making out like a bandit right now in his Halliburton stock, as Halliburton is doing well. But it nearly brought down the Harding administration. It cast the Republicans in a horrible light. It helped solidify. I mean, if Harding, you know, went on to Hoover, but it's nonetheless, or yeah, Coolidge and then Hoover. I would say it even helped solidify the base of support for Franklin Roosevelt ultimately. Everybody looked back at Teapot Dome and said, oh, yeah, that's what those Republicans are all about. They're all about, you know, taking the public good and converting it into the private gain. And that was like a major scandal. I mean, we still study it in high school, the Teapot Dome scandal. And yet what is going on today with regard to war, and Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War launched investigations and sent people to prison for war profiteering. And Harry Truman, as United States Senator, started a commission to investigate the Roosevelt administration for war profiteering. And Roosevelt went along with it and said, yeah, find the bums and put them in jail. And Truman held hundreds of hearings, and people ended up being convicted and going to jail. And President Roosevelt, these guys were in the same party. And here's Truman going after Roosevelt. And Roosevelt was so pleased that Truman was helping to clean up the effort to fight World War II that he asked him to be his vice president the next time he was renominated to run for president. And yet here we have the Bush administration committing cronyism, crony capitalism on a scale that we have never before seen in the United States. We're talking trillions of dollars. Trillions of
criminal.
Dollars. And it is beyond criminal. It's treasonous. And nobody wants to talk about it, in large part because some of the very corporations that are getting this money have interlocking boards of directors, and you can find all this over at theyrule.net, the amazing website. They have interlocking boards of directors with the companies, with the media companies.
He can't give money to stem cell research, but he can sure throw our money away to companies that don't help anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, it is absolutely mind-boggling. John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pam.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I heard the caller that just called in, and I watched Amy's show yesterday, and I just thought I'd mention something interesting in addition to what he said. It was Greg Palast, for one thing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and the
good
other
guy.
Thing is he did interview this company, and they were called IEM,
mm-hmm.
and they had been contracted, and he found out, I mean, he did find out, even though they wouldn't interview him except behind a glass door, and then they threw him out after a few questions. But anyway, found that they had absolutely no plan whatsoever. That was their plan, no plan.
The plan is no plan. Now, was this specific to Katrina?
This is the topper. And so he goes through all this and all these other interviews with all these people in New Orleans and stuff, and he comes to find out at the very, very end, it's like the kind of closing, you know, line, uh-huh. that the company that's been hired to see what went wrong during this disaster, to evaluate this, is IEM.
The company that had no plan in the first place.
Yeah.
Amazing. I just thought that bit of irony
shouldn't pass.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing it with our listeners, Pam.
It was, by the way, check the archives on that, because that was an incredible interview that Greg did yesterday.
Yeah, I'll do it. Thanks a lot, Pam.
Okay, thanks.
Good
Bye-bye.
To hear from you. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Tom, there was some disgusting news Saturday down in Maywood, California, where the protesters were supposedly illegal immigrants, took the American flag down from City Hall and the post office in Maywood. And there was nothing.
This is a community that's 96% Latino, and the Minutemen went in there to do an anti-Latino, what was perceived as an anti-Latino protest, and this was the response they got. You're surprised by that?
Well, you know what? What gets me is when you take the American flag down from a federal facility, isn't that, you know, you're conquering that area.
Well, you know, you're not.
Where is the Homeland Security? Where is the governor?
The police went in and they climbed up, and it took them a few minutes, but they got the flag down. I mean, this was a protest, Jim. Come on, I know the right wingers are all out of breath about it, but you know, calm down.
Okay, well, wait a minute. One thing, I looked at a whole batch of pictures that was taken down there,
yeah.
and what I've seen was the police were taking pictures of the people with the American flags, but not the ones behind the Mexican barricade.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I got to tell you, you go into a Latino community with essentially a racist message, and I wouldn't, you know, you shouldn't be surprised if you get some blowback. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Come heed me, good brothers, come here one and all. Don't brag about standing or you'll surely fall. You're shining your light and shine it you should. But you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. No earthly good, you are no earthly good.
Oh, gee, it's a sound of
you're
song
so
about George W.
Heavenly minded, you are no earthly good.
Thank you, Johnny. Welcome back. 9.5 you're minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Somebody has actually gone and calculated this. This is absolutely amazing. I just put the link over it in the message board. If you go to TomHartman.com and click on the message board blog area and then go to the national radio show, it's the top story right now. It's gas prices and Bush approval ratings is the headline. And starting in January of 01 up through January of 05, they graphed with one color Bush's approval ratings and with another color the reciprocal of the price of gasoline. In other words, when the graph goes up, it means that the price of gas went down. And the two absolutely perfectly parallel. Whenever Bush's approval ratings go down, the price of gas goes down. So then his approval ratings go back up again, and so they jack the price of gas up. It's incredible. Angela in Marianne, Florida. Hey, Angela, welcome to the program.
I called in because gas in some places here in Florida have dropped like 25 cents a gallon.
Yeah, there's an election coming.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if people are really that gullible to, you know, we have heavy races going on with the Democrat and Republicans here, and people shouldn't be fooled by it because as soon as they get what they want, it's going to go right back up again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, Reagan did this in his first, both in the midterm elections, but primarily in the election of, what was it, 84, I think it was. I mean, you know, just they make things really, really bad and then make them a little bit better just before the election. And everybody goes, oh, things are getting better.
Right.
Hey, well, for these guys. Now, you ought to check this thing out, Angela. I just, Bush approval, it's a fact. In fact, it's a guess. This is copyright by Stuart Eugene Thiel. And he put this thing together. Is Bush's approval ratings go up, the price of gas goes up. When Bush's approval ratings go down, the price of gas goes down. And is it any coincidence that Bush is an oil industry CEO and Cheney's an oil industry CEO, and the oil industry is making out like bandits? Gee, what a shock. What an absolute shock.
Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot for the... Oh, Angela, go ahead.
Oh, could I say one more thing?
Sure.
I was kind of wondering about this because now... Is this Jeb Bush? I mean, has Jeb Bush pulled out of the Republic? See, I'm not the Republican race because we have Republicans and Democrats running for the governorship, and so I'm wondering: is Jeb pulling out, or is this just the?
I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't live in Florida, and I haven't paid that much attention to it. I'll have to check it out now. You've got my curiosity going. I just don't know. But Angela, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to us there in Marianna, Florida. Armin in Florida also. Hey, Armin, is Jeb running for re-election?
I think he's running from something.
That was a serious question, Armin. Come on.
That was a serious answer.
Oh, you're not sure? You don't know?
No, I want to bring up something else, if I may, please.
Sure.
I live down here, but most people that live down here are too busy paying for the Bush crime family's fees and services and rip-offs to sit around too much actively watching what those crooks are up to.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
I do. I mean, this is why they're destroying the middle class, because back in the 60s and 70s, they got it. When you have a strong and healthy and active middle class, they speak out politically, and that's the last thing that plutocrats want.
You got it all figured out, Tom. You're really brilliant. The question is,
great minds think alike here, Armin.
Well, I wish I was half as smart as you, but I try.
And you're doing a fine job. You said the question is.
Well, the question is, how can we take all this knowledge that we have, you know, collectively out there, and you know, the majority of the people in this country, I'm convinced in my heart that the people that are aware, that are capable of understanding what's ensuing against the middle class, I believe that 70% of the people in this country now, I believe it's that strong, oppose this regime. And if they could, you know, if we had voting machines that really had transparency and had receipts, that there wouldn't be any question these people would be out, you know, the day after the election.
Or but, districts. I mean, you know, redistricting has done an awful lot of this. It's amazing what they've done by drawing districts and getting safe seats. We need to have a law that says that congressional districts shall be defined by counties, for example.
Pardon? There needs to be much more transparency and fairness in the process of selecting them, too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just very
straightforward. Tom, I heard something that's really alarming me, and if it's true, it's a rumor, and it's from a reliable source. I can't confirm it or deny it. Would you check into it?
Real quick.
But there's been a real distinct change in CNN's, quote, news tracking and what they what subjects they cover. And it's come to my attention that a real, very, very wealthy investor that's invested in the Carlyle Group is also now a very heavy investor in CNN. And if that's the case, that would make a lot of sense.
You know, I don't know off the top of my head, Armin, but we'll look into it. John, also in Florida, you have inside info on what's up with Jeb?
Yeah, well, Tom, what's happening is the commercials that they're running now are calling all the guys that are running, all the Republicans that are running for office now, they're calling them Jeb Bush Republicans. That's actually what they're saying on the commercial.
Oh, interesting, because Jeb Bush himself is not running for re-election?
I don't think so, no.
Interesting. Okay, John, thanks a lot. I guess I'm going to have to bone up on politics in Florida. I just, you know, hadn't been keeping track of it. I didn't realize he was up for re-election this year, you know, that there was a gubernatorial election in Florida this time around. Interesting. Well, he's got to get ready for his run for the presidency in 2 years. I mean, it was Jeb who was originally going to be running for president. That's why he signed off on the program for New American Century, you know, the whole thing. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
So what's really going on down there in New Orleans, in Louisiana, and Mississippi, and the whole area with regard to the Reconstruction? Is it being done right? Is it being done well? Is it being done efficiently? Is it being done at all? Chris Kamm is with us. He's with ReconstructionWatch.org, the executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies, ReconstructionWatch.org, the website. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what is, by the way, are you familiar with this spoof of this guy who spoke at the same lectern as Kathleen Blanco and Ray Nagin apparently yesterday or the day before?
Well, everybody's trying to figure out who Rocky exactly is. We do know that he was a Republican candidate for local office, and it was quite a feat to find somebody who's happy about how the Reconstruction's gone into New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, because you talk to almost anybody down there, and they'll tell you what our report concluded that we just released this week, is that the recovery's been a failure, and that hundreds of thousands of people are still in limbo. And that's the majority sentiment, and I think recent polls bear that out, too.
Yeah. I wasn't speaking of the Rocky character who got in to see the president. This is over at the Daily Kos, and I'm assuming that it's true, but I don't know for certain. Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin each thanked the man identified as a federal housing representative who followed them to the lectern Monday to announce a major reversal in policy. He called himself Rene Oswin, said he was the assistant deputy secretary for U.S. Department of Housing and Urban. He said they were going to stop tearing down perfectly good public housing, said they were going to spend $180 million to fund at least one well-equipped public health clinic for every housing development, that they were going to replace public schools or reverse plans to replace public schools with private and charter schools and instead create a national tax base to supplement local taxes.
Yeah, this is brilliant. He's one of the members of the Yes Men, this group that they go around and sometimes they impersonate that they're part of the World Trade Organization, and they speak as if they're members of that group. group and talk about how they're going to miserate people in other countries, and the audience all clap their hands. And so he did the same spoof there in Louisiana, and I know who you're talking about now. And, he unveiled this program, which is one that is the right approach, which is that we shouldn't be demolishing public housing while people can't find homes in New Orleans, and we should be supporting attempts to get health care and housing back up on its feet. But when they found out it was a spoof, the first response of HUD officials would to say that the man was sick for saying all that, when clearly he was just laying out in the spoof exactly what should be happening if he wants the region to come back.
Well, I'm waiting for them for the announcement that he's being prosecuted for impersonating a federal officer. Federal official.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, no, me neither. We're talking with Chris Kamm. He is the executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies about, you know, what's happening 1 year later after Katrina. And Chris, the tearing down of public housing, for example, you just mentioned that this Yes Man guy got up yesterday and said that they were going to stop, and in fact, they're moving ahead with. Is this part of, I mean, there are these rather dark conspiracy theories that have been running around for the better part of a year now, that really the reason why New Orleans and several of the nearby parishes, the nearby counties, have gotten so little support, or the support that they've gotten has been so cosmetic, let's say, at the very best, is because these are Democratic, primarily Democratic areas. They voted for John Kerry in the election. They are not supporters of George W. Bush. And the tearing down of public housing and the demolition of other housing in the area is paving the way for the Disneyfication, essentially, of New Orleans. Let's reinvent it as a nice white bread, and white, racially white, community that will become Republican and have the appearance of New Orleans, but not the character of it. Is there anything, do you think, to that?
Well, we can start with the evidence, which is just the fact that over the last 12 months, just like people in the Gulf were left behind when the storms hit last August, the fact is a year down the line, the same people are being left behind again. It is low-income, working-class people, African-Americans, children, the elderly, everyone who was left behind when the storms hit. 12 months down the line, they're being left behind again. And the biggest reason, what our report finds through hundreds of statistical indicators, in-depth investigations, that all of these go back to Washington. They all took federal leadership, federal accountability. That's where the buck stopped on these issues. And if they had taken action, these problems could have been resolved.
Now,
housing, education, health care, you go down the line, these are all things that it was ultimately a federal job. And the fact that they haven't acted on them, I think that's why people, when you talk to them in the Gulf, they have these conspiracies about why don't they seem to care.
Were these the failure of government to act appropriately, or the willful actions of government restraining appropriate responses?
I think it's both. One is just sheer neglect, and you can interpret that as either an active phenomenon or just forgetting. But the fact is that, you know, on issue after issue, housing, homeowners haven't seen a dime of the assistance that was promised to them, even as insurance companies are bailing out. If you're a renter, there's been no effort to rebuild rental housing. Just down the line, just sheer neglect of not putting money and taking the leadership to do these things. But where they have wanted to take action, they have been bold and aggressive in doing so. So, for example, they quickly put $9 billion into the hands of connected contractors, politically connected companies like the Halliburtons and Bechtels, to do the rebuilding, even though FEMA had been told in 2004 that they were supposed to create a database of small businesses and local businesses and minority businesses that were supposed to get these contracts in the wake of disaster. They didn't do it. So when the storms hit, they just started shelling it out to the big companies. So they quickly acted on those issues. They also quickly put a lot of money into the hands of private security firms and issues of security and policing. So those areas got money, rescuing the Army bases and the naval shipyards. Those all got a lot of money and were acted on right away. But when it came to hospitals, when it came to schools, when it came to housing, when it came to cleaning up the environment, when it came to even rebuilding the levees, they just dragged their feet. And so you can see that as a political decision making. It's not just lack of leadership, it's misplaced priorities.
The response to Hurricanes Charley and Frances, which hit Florida, was very, very different. I mean, FEMA had pre-positioned in both be the case of both of those hurricanes in 2004. Pre-positioned trucks, pre-positioned, I mean, water, ice, food. They even had fruit baskets and hams, you know. I mean, they mobilized 4,100 National Guardsmen. They pulled in resources from other states. They were ready when those hurricanes hit in Florida. And this was at the federal level. This was all federal activity. Why the sudden, so we know that FEMA, in the Bush administration, knows how to function and knows how to function quite well because they did. With Brownie at the head, they functioned quite well with these two hurricanes in Florida, and they were rather significant events. And people say, well, you know, they weren't as bad as Hurricane Katrina. No, they weren't as bad as Hurricane Katrina, but the fact of the matter is that FEMA got stuff down there and was ready in ways that they weren't for Katrina at all. Why the difference?
Well, I think what's interesting, too, is you saw, for example, you know, you didn't see any of the emphasis on security about handing out huge contracts like Blackwater International to start policing areas of South Florida or, you know, the golf resorts or wherever was getting hit. You didn't see that same attention to those issues. But suddenly when the victims are African-American and low-income and working class, the first thing you need to do is get out as much security detail as possible. Another interesting comparison is after those hurricanes in Florida, the papers like the St. Petersburg Times actually did some good stories about how much fraud there was and people collecting, spending the money that they'd gotten from FEMA in places maybe they shouldn't have, and how they were given more money in a lot of cases than they were authorized to give. But of course, that never made the national news, that somehow the people of South Florida were collecting too much at the taxpayers' dime.
Right.
Stark contrast to the coverage you've seen to the survivors of Hurricane Katrina, which massive front page stories about waste and graft of these small-time scam artists supposedly using their $2,000 allowance in the wrong ways. Of course, meanwhile, as our report documents, the amount that's been wasted on big contracts is 50 times that amount. So that's an interesting contrast to what happened in Florida, too.
Again, does this come back to Bush administration ideology, believing that, you know, private corporations can do things better than government, or is this helping your friends and hurting your enemies politically?
Well, I think there is some just direct cronyism involved, like Carnival Cruise Lines, you know, the infamous, which got tens of hundreds of millions of dollars to put up people in their cruise ships after Katrina. I mean, that was solely because Jeb Bush, who'd received campaign contributions from Carnival Cruise Lines, put an email into Michael Brown saying, hey, you should give these people a contract to put up victims of the hurricane Katrina at the cost of some $240,000 for a few months' stay. So there was some just direct corruption, but also there was the overall philosophy, the go zones, the trickle-down recovery, which just hasn't worked.
Well said. Chris Kamm, he's the executive director of the Institute for Southern Studies. Their website, reconstructionwatch.org. Check it out. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Good talking with you. And keep a good eye on this stuff. You guys are doing great work. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, Truth in Broadcasting for a Change.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend. I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend.
And welcome back, fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartmann here defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Ellen Ratner's on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Ellen, you made it out of the Gulf Coast before the hordes of reporters descended?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, the place looked like the New Hampshire primary. And, you know, Tom, what's interesting is when I saw that Armstrong Williams, who, to my knowledge, has not been in the Gulf one time, was giving a press conference about the role, essentially, of conservative African-Americans in the Gulf, you know what? I said, this is complete BS. And the Democrats, too, you know, a lot of them are, everybody knows there are huge problems there. But as I think I said to you earlier, people need to roll up their sleeves and work. And the other thing, Tom, is the president is there, and he's saying that if there's another hurricane, the United States is prepared. Well, that isn't my read on it. And then he's saying, well, you know, the levees have been brought up to their pre-Katrina levels. Yes, well, okay, but the levees were not ready for this kind of situation.
Yeah, there and wasn't there a significant difference, Ellen Ratner, between the competence of the levees, I mean the structural competence of the levees, of the levees in the poor areas versus the structural competence of the levees in the wealthier areas?
You know, I just toured New Orleans, and I got to tell you, the wealthy areas got it. The Garden District and the French Quarter did not get it, but
that's because they're high land, right?
There are some gated communities where homes are $1 million, and they got it just as bad as Ward 9. So, and a lot of bedroom communities, you know, they've lost 77% of the physicians in the area.
Yeah, yeah,
and they will not come back.
There's a nursing shortage. Over 1,000 nurses are needed.
Oh, absolutely. The entire charity hospital is closed.
Yeah. Are you familiar with this this gag that the Yes Men did yesterday?
No.
The Yes Men. This is like the Billionaires for Bush Bunch. You know, it's and they Kathleen Blanco got up and gave a speech, and Ray Nagin gave a speech, and then this guy got up and introduced himself as Assistant Deputy Secretary for U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Renee Oswin. And he said that the HUD was going to reverse their policy instead of destroying 5,000 units of perfectly good public housing, that they were going to keep them. He says former occupants have been begging to move back in. We're going to help them do that. He says Walmart should withdraw has agreed to withdraw its stores from near low-income housing and help nurture local businesses to replace them, that the federal government is going to spend $180 million to fund at least one well-equipped public health center for every housing development, and that the feds are going to reverse plans to replace public schools with charter schools and private schools and instead create a national tax base to supplement local taxes. He says, with your help, the prospects of New Orleanians will no longer depend on their birthplace and the cycle of poverty will come to an end. And he also said Exxon and Shell had promised to spend $8.6 billion to finance wetlands rebuilding from $60 billion in profits this year. Everybody applauded, and it was all, he made it all up.
You know, what's hysterical is that the place where they had this event yesterday was being put together when I was there over the weekend. And there were all these guys putting down sod. And as they put down the sod, we went out to talk to them. Well, they were Mexican and Honduras workers who had been in the area for 1 year only. They came after Hurricane Katrina. So here you were. You know, Mexicans and people from Honduras laying down sod to make this park look good for a dedication from the mayor and from the governor.
So they were insourcing the local work, basically.
Exactly.
Incredible. Incredible. I'm surprised, frankly, that this guy, you know, spoofing HUD and frankly saying what should be done. I mean, he did a good job of articulating really what should be done in the area. And the official response has been that it was a sick joke and that the guy was twisted and all this kind of, that the news media hasn't picked this up and run with it more.
Amazing.
Have you seen any coverage of the Yes Men spoof by any of the major networks?
No, I actually haven't. I've really been spending my time sort of recovering from my 5 days down there and really also talking to people because, you know, I mean, the stuff that the Bush administration has put out is just such a load of, you know what, it's hard for me to even grok how they could have the nerve to put some of this stuff out.
Ellen, do you think that George W. Bush going down there and trying to, you know, put lipstick on this thing, that he's going to end up making things worse for himself, or is he going to pull out a public relations
I actually think that he is not going to get the points, because anybody who, I mean, the news media did do a very good job, this I did watch, showing where he spoke in Biloxi and showing what was right around these supposedly restored homes. And I think they did a pretty good job showing that this was a photo op. And I got to hand it to the news media. They haven't had great coverage, but they did do good. They did do a good job on this one.
Yeah. Okay, great. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Ellen, thank you very much. Great talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll be back right after this break.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts unto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We've heard from several of our Florida listeners that Jeb Bush is leaving office because term limits require him to leave office. Interesting. Thank you for that tip. Didn't know that. And in the challenging to debate categories, here in Oregon, the governor, this is interesting. I would love to see more governors around the country doing this. Governor Kulongoski, the Democrat who is the governor of Oregon, has challenged Howie Rich, a multimillionaire in New York, who lives in New York, does not live in Oregon, has nothing to do with Oregon, has challenged him to a debate. Why? Because Howie Rich wrote a check for over $1 million to get a tax cut or Tabor-like initiative, basically, Tabor for Oregon, on the ballot here in Oregon. Oregon being a state where there's a few enough people that with a relatively small amount of money, you can influence legislation. You can do, it's a testing ground. If you can do it for $1 million in Oregon successfully, then you'll put, you know, $30 million at risk in California kind of thing, or in New York State. And so the governor has said to Howie Rich, this millionaire in New York, who funded this thing, who wrote the check for it and, you know, hired a local guy to do it, a local front man, said, hey, I want to debate you. And Rich says, nah, you get to talk to my local guys. Along the same lines, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on Tuesday challenged George Bush to a televised debate. This from Reuters. He voiced defiance as a deadline neared for Iran to halt work the West fears is a step toward building nuclear bombs. The White House said Ahmadinejad's call for a presidential debate on global concerns was a diversion from international concerns over Iran's nuclear program. Boy, I'd love to see a debate between Bush and Ahmadinejad. I mean, Ahmadinejad believes that the hidden mufti is going to return with fire over Baghdad. He is a believer in a millennialist, in a rapture sect within Shia Islam, that, you know, they have the belief in the rapture, that it's going to happen any day now. In fact, I got spooked, you know, chills in the bad sense, watching Ahmadinejad. This was maybe 3-4 months ago when he first announced that they had successfully enriched uranium beyond 3%. And he started out his speech by saying, you know, here we stand in the presence of Allah and, you know, these people and those people and the hidden mufti. And I thought, oh, no, he's a member. He's one of them. But Bush is part of, you know, a very similar sect. So it would be interesting to hear them debate this. You know, which one of our raptures is the one that's actually going to happen? And it's time to turn the world, control the world back over to adults. I'll tell you. You heard the third worldization of the USA, by the way. This via Raw Story. Rawstory.com. This is actually from crooksandliars.com is where it was posted, but you hear and it was posted by RJ. He says, you hear the comment all the time from people on both sides of the political fence that it seems as if the United States' basic structure and service capability has declined and that things are going to hell in a handbasket. They'll make vague complaints that nothing works anymore or that things have degraded to a third world level, meaning to the level of a country that lacks the resources to maintain its basic functionality. Well, writes R.J. Eskow, it turns out they're right. The American Society of Civil Engineers last year graded the nation D for its overall infrastructure conditions, estimating it would take $1.6 trillion over 5 years to fix the problem. I would add, by the way, doing that would be a massive stimulus to the economy. I mean, you want to build the American economy? Rebuild our infrastructure. That's what Eisenhower did and helped build an extraordinarily successful middle class in the United States. The results include leaking pipelines, failed air traffic control systems in major metro areas, power failure that paralyzed the NSA, bridge failures, all sorts of potential disasters. This is the American Society of Engineers director says, I thought Hurricane Katrina was was a hell of a wake-up call, but people are missing the alarm. Another analyst observes, if a terrorist group were to knock the NSA offline or disrupt one of the nation's busiest airports or shut down the most important oil pipeline in the nation, the impact would be perceived as devastating, and yet we've essentially let these things happen, or almost happen, to ourselves. I mean, think of the political hay that George Bush would make with this if a terrorist took out the pipeline up there in Alaska that it turns out BP's negligence is taking out. Or was able to knock the National Security Agency offline, as was the consequence of crumbling infrastructure. Well, you could argue Bush himself did it. Certainly his political philosophy did it. Again, going back to this whole thing of Reagan declaring war on democracy.
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And he always got a laugh. And now the laugh's on, well, now no one's laughing. RJ writes over at Raw Story, he says, and of course on liars.com, one function of government is to ensure that its citizens have a safe and functional physical environment. Problem is that we have a political movement in power that doesn't believe in government. They would rather drown it in a bathtub or in the Ninth Ward. Yeah. Well said. I mean, this is so true. Paul Krugman was blogging about this over at the New York Times, or writing about it. You know, he's columnizing, whatever. Talking about how a year ago, back in September, Bush standing in New Orleans saying, Katrina, this is going to be one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen. And then he leaves and they dismantle the set. Now he's back and they put the set back up, complete with laying sod, as Ellen points out, bringing in probably illegal immigrant labor to lay sod so that it could look like Bush was in a place that was being rebuilt. Turns out, writes Paul Krugman in the New York Times, of the $18 billion that Congress has appropriated for reconstruction, only 2% has been spent. So it's like the United States and Iraq. You know, the two places that were supposed to be rebuilt by the Bushies, in both cases they turned it over to cronies and buddies of the Bush administration. And in both cases, what's the consequence? A disaster. Just an absolute disaster. Homeland Security Undersecretary George Foreman told reporters, this was July 16th on NBC, he says, frankly, we just have not in this country put the premium on our level of catastrophe planning that's necessary to be ready for these wide-scale events. Well, we still haven't. 80% of American cities still lack sufficient communications equipment. More than half lack emergency preparedness plans. 8 in 10 cities say their emergency responders still can't communicate with each other or other towns. 44% have not created or updated evacuation plans, and nearly three-quarters say they're not prepared to handle something like a flu pandemic. FEMA was supposed to update Louisiana's evacuation and shelter plans in time for the 2006 hurricane season. You may recall Kathleen Blanco pointing this out to Mr. Chertoff last year. Didn't get much press coverage. Bush says, you can't drive through this state, he's talking about Mississippi, without seeing signs of recovery and renewal. Just impossible to miss the signs of hope. And you've done it the old-fashioned way, with vision and hard work and resolve. Yeah. Fewer than 5% of the destroyed homes are being rebuilt right now in Mississippi's Gulf Coast. With regard to Katrina, he says, we've committed more than $3 billion in housing grants. The money's already beginning to flow to the homeowners. Well, 1 year after Hurricane Katrina struck, there are still approximately 7,500 families in the metro area alone who are still waiting for a trailer from FEMA. Bush says, it's important for planners and job creators to know the incentives will be there, so we put out small business loans. No. About 60% of the businesses within the city limits have probably not reopened. This is in the New York Times, according to a recent study by Louisiana State University, which tried to call about 8,500 of the 10,000 businesses registered with the state. At about 5,000 of the businesses, the phone had been disconnected or was not answered after five calls. Bush has not done, the Bush administration, the Republicans have not done the job. And then Bush says, well, you know, we are doing some good reconstruction in Mississippi. Why? Because Haley Barbour is a good friend of mine. Haley Barbour used to be the head of the RNCs. Now, it's incredible. Bush claiming that the reason why Mississippi is being rebuilt faster than Louisiana is because it's got a Republican governor and Republican senators and a Republican member of the House. Amazing. Hey, Richard on the line. Hey, Richard, I don't see the city you're in. What is it?
Calling from Seattle today.
Oh, okay, great. Hey, what's up?
Well, I was listening halfway to the radio, and I heard you going down this litany of depleted infrastructure that needed to be rebuilt. And I thought we were doing the wartime in Iraq scenario. I mean, it sounded like the same problems that are going on in Baghdad.
And, you know, the money's being allocated here, and the money's being allocated there, and in both cases it's going to end up with the stockholders of Halliburton, but it's not going to end up rebuilding the infrastructure.
It's the same problem.
Yeah.
The big corporations are getting the money, and the little people who are trying to rebuild their lives are getting squat.
Yeah, it's absolutely getting screwed, and to paraphrase or to use the title of my new book. Yeah, you know, it's absolutely, and it's time for us to stand up and say, enough already. Richard, thanks for the call. Enough already. We're not going to take it anymore. We're just not going to take it anymore. We're going to change this, and we're going to change this at the ballot box in November. We're going to change it in overwhelming numbers. And so I say right now is the time for you to contact your local Democratic Party headquarters, your local county Democratic Party, and say, how can I show up? How can I help out? Where do you need somebody to go door to door and hand out flyers and knock on doors or make phone calls or do a get out the vote effort? Because this November is critical. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Why do the baby starve? There's enough food to feed the world. Why wouldn't there so many of us so that people still alone? Why are the little called peacekeepers when there ain't to kill? Why is a woman still not safe when she's in her home? Love is hate, war is peace, no is yes. We're all free, but somebody's gonna have to answer. The time is coming soon. Amidst all the contradictions, some will see through. Tell me, why do the
and welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, or we'll be in about 15 seconds. Tom Hartman here with you. You're in the middle of the democracy zone, the no boring zone. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Dave in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, Dave, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was looking over your graph on the gas prices and the Bush approval rating.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? It's actually not mine. It's put together by, what's the guy's name, Stuart Eugene Thiel. But there's a link to it over at on our message board over at TomHartman.com.
Well, I was compelled to look because I'll never forget back in 2004, you know, being involved in the market, we were watching the price per barrel of oil. And in August of 2004 is when that price per barrel started creeping up and busting through $50 a barrel. And I'll never forget for the following 2 to 3 months, on the pundits on CNBC, et cetera, we're all out there saying they were amazed that it wasn't being reflected in the pump price.
Right. And what's interesting is that you look at this graph and you see that every time Bush's approval ratings go up, the price of gasoline then goes up. Like they say, okay, we're safe now. We can jack up the price. And every time he starts to tank in the polls, they drop the price of gas. Like, hey, we need to help our friend out. And it has no relation to the price of crude.
Right. And if you can see that spot, that dead zone in your graph there where it didn't rise, but if you overlaid the price per barrel, it was flying up, breaking through 50 for the first time. And But the price of gas at the pump didn't go up, of course, until after the election. And I kind of predict that we'll see the same effect going into the midterms,
mm-hmm.
the dropping of gas, which we're seeing now at the pump.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I think that's going to be one of two little stocking stuffers for the October surprise. The other will be, I think the Fed will cut interest rates in October just before the elections.
Well, if they want it to have an effect, they're going to have to do it at the next Fed meeting, because the cut in interest rates, you know, it takes 2 or 3 months for that to become.
It's a not the actual effect, the perception.
No, I mean, it takes a couple of months for that to start changing the way people behave with regard to buying and selling houses, and then that changes the statistics.
That would be actual, but I think what the perception that people will think that the game is on again for housing.
Oh, I see. Yeah, see, I'm concerned that they're going to have to cut interest rates just simply to prevent a disaster. I mean, in the New York Times on Sunday, there was an article where they graphed housing prices from 1890 to today, where 1890 was, you know, $100,000 house in 1890. What would it cost today? And they showed that there was a period of time in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s when it dropped below the 100% line. And then there was a time in the double booms of the 80s and the 90s when it went up to like 120, you know, on the index. But then starting about 5 years ago, this is when Greenspan started dropping interest rates down into the negative range to try and help get himself reelected in 2004 and to help the Republicans in 2002. You saw the price of housing go spike up over 200. In other words, it doubled. Over the average, since 1890. It's like the Dutch tulip, bubble. That is an absolutely unsustainable bubble.
Well,
And I'm starting to agree with these economic prognosticators who are suggesting that we're going to see a 30 to 50% drop in housing prices in a lot of the United States.
We saw that in California, but what's even worse about the situation is what the end result was, is that the money was pulled out, the equity, these people self-consumed. They consumed their future, their financial independence, their retirements.
Well, that's the thing. Last year, for the first time, as far as I know, in the history of the United States, I think the reason that it didn't happen in the Great Depression of the Republican Great Depression of the 30s or the Republican Great Depression back in the 1890s is because credit simply wasn't available. But last year, for the first time in the history of the United States, the average American, in fact, America as a whole, spent more money than we brought in. Our consumption exceeded our wages.
And negative savings rate.
That's right. It was a negative savings rate and ultimately this just should not happen. You know, I mean, it just should not happen.
Well, people considered that to be income and wealth, and it wasn't. It was debt, and that's the most amazing thing to do.
Yeah,
know.
Well, they were seeing the increased value of their house, and you can tell so much of what's going on, Dave, by just looking at the TV commercials. When you see all kinds of TV commercials promoting, you know, remortgage your house and use it like an ATM machine, you know that there's a bubble going on. When you see all kinds of TV commercials for, hey, you want to borrow money for school loans, you know, you got a school loan problem. I mean, you know, it's amazing. You just look at the commercials and you can see which direction things are going and how bad they're getting. So anyway, Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Good points you made all and much appreciated. I am very concerned about this. And I tell you, in my own life, you know, Louise and I are working to get debt free. And I just think that it's something that all of us need to do to the extent that it's possible, is to either get debt free or to make sure that any of your long-term debt is at a fixed rate and a relatively low rate, and that you are building equity. I'd be very, very spooked by these interest-only loans or these adjustable-rate mortgages, things like that. And it's not, I don't think, a good time to be going out and buying things, big things like new cars and things, on credit. And I realize that that's not what, you know, Bush says, oh, 9/11, yes, go shopping. You know, but, hey, there's a time to protect yourself and protect your family. And I think this is it. I really do. These guys, they have spent us, you know, trillions of dollars into debt. The debt of the United States has never been like it is right now. And the Bushies and the other multimillionaires and billionaires, you know, laughing all the way to the bank. But the rest of us need to get a roof over our heads, as it were. We need to get some protection for the storm that's coming. Because I'm telling you, after the elections, they'll probably hold it together until November. But after the elections, it's going to be tough. 57 minutes after that.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Now, if I were the pastor of a mega church with a PhD in theology and morbidly obese, what... Well, actually, you could take that last part out. I shouldn't personalize this too much to Mr. the Reverend Dr. Falwell. What would I be talking about right now? Given that it's a year out from Katrina, there are human beings who are not hungry, who are not fed, who are hungry, who are not fed, who are homeless, who are not sheltered, who... You know, to paraphrase Jesus in Matthew 25, naked and without clothing. I mean, obviously they're not literally naked, but who are lacking the fundamental necessities of life, who are sick and not being healed. This is the foundation of Christianity. It's the foundation, frankly, of all religions. But specifically speaking of Mr. Falwell, you know, when he came along with his...
Upright, strong, and brazen.
So this is Jerry Falwell.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
Yeah. Okay, so on it goes. And Falwell out there promoting his very bizarre agenda. If he's not promoting Republican politics, he's promoting the same ideas that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is, which is the end of the world is coming, therefore what? I mean, I would think, and again, I you know, I'm not the pastor of a megachurch, don't have a PhD in theology. I have read the Bible a few times. I have been active in, what do you call it, Christianity and religion for years. But, you know, maybe Jerry Falwell knows something I don't. But I would think that, you know, what would Jesus talk about right now would be not worrying about a cashless society. Apparently Jerry Falwell is very concerned about this. Maybe he's got $100 bills stashed under his mattress. He's afraid they're going to be taken away from him. But instead, I would be concerned about what about the people from Hurricane Katrina? What about the people in America? What about the fact that under the Bush administration, poverty is going up, not down? What about the fact that the number of uninsured, when Bush became, you know, in 2000, when Clinton's last year was 39 million uninsured in the United States, the end of Bush's first year was up to 41 million. At the end of his second year, it was up to 43 million. At the end of his third year, it was up to 45 million. And now it's up to 46.5 million. The number of uninsured. But the number of people living below the poverty line. When Clinton left office, 31 million. Then it went to 32 million, almost 33, 32.9 million in 2001. Went to 34 million in 2002, 35.9 million in 2003, 37 million in 2004, and 37 million now. I mean, don't you think that he'd be talking about that? Well, here's what Falwell is preaching about.
I expect the Lord to return in the 21st century to rapture out his church.
Yeah, it's going to be the rapture. It's the hidden mufti. You got Ahmadinejad, I'm concerned about the hidden mufti, and you got Falwell and Bush worried about the rapture.
I can't prove that. I cannot prove that the Lord is going to come in this century. No one knows the day of the hour, but in my heart, I believe it, because there are no more predicted events that need to happen before our Lord can return.
Well, actually, if you go back and you read Hal Lindsey, the temple has to be rebuilt. You know, this is what Alan Goodman was trying to do. I was in Israel when this happened. This guy goes up to the Temple Mount and tries to throw up a pup tent so he can call it the Second Temple. It's over where the old temple used to be, Solomon's Temple. And it's by coincidence right next to the Dome of the Rock. I mean, it's an area. There's a sign that says, you know, if you're Jewish, you're not supposed to walk here, according to the high rabbi of Jerusalem, because you might accidentally defile a temple, might walk over it. So Alan Goodman went up there and thought he was going to build this. He's going to, you know, bring down Jesus or bring back the Messiah. I mean, there are very, very conservative Orthodox communities in Jerusalem where you see bumper stickers that say Mashiach now, you know. And they tried to stop him, pulls out a machine gun, starts killing people. I mean, you consider the weirdness that's been done. So, well, I'd say, Jerry, you still have a few prophecies to go. And that's assuming that you accept Hal Lindsey's interpretation of it, which is increasingly being viewed as flaky, but nonetheless.
I expect a global economy in the 21st century, which first will manifest itself as a cashless society.
Oh, this is something to be really worried about. Now, frankly, it's impossible. You know, it's impossible. But I suppose, you know, in some sort of, if Bush keeps going, if the Bush administration keeps going, you know, wanting all the, I got a check. I went to the doctor yesterday. Haven't done that in a couple of years. Thought, geez, you know, I've been living here for a little over a year in Portland, year and a half. I ought to go get my blood pressure checked and how are my triglycerides and all that kind of junk, right? So went in, and they made a photocopy of my driver's license. They made a photocopy. They want all this, and then I had to sign this form that says we can give your information to anybody we want, you know. And I'm like, what's that? Well, the new law says the insurance companies will do this, and you want your insurance to pay for this, you're going to have to give up your privacy. Oh. So the Bushies and the Republicans, maybe they are the Antichrist.
I believe that plastic will take the place of cash, and that while this will only be fulfilled during the tribulation period after the rapture, I believe that God is setting the stage for and laying the infrastructure for a cashless society right now.
Well, this is interesting. After the rapture, he says, so we have this battle now in Christianity between the post-millennialists and the premillennialists, those who believe that Jesus will come and then things will get bad, versus, and then ultimately there'll be 1,000 years of peace, versus those who think things are going to get bad and then Jesus will come and then 1,000 years of peace will happen. Right? There's actually a battle in Christianity between these two factions. And in the midst of this, we have Catherine Harris, the woman who, as Secretary of State in Florida, stole the election for George W. Bush in the year 2000 by throwing 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, guaranteeing that the election would be close enough that the members of the Supreme Court appointed by George W. Bush's father would be able to push him over the top and install him. She said this week that God doesn't intend for the United States to be a nation of secular laws. Oh, really, Catherine? And that a failure to elect Christians to political office will allow lawmaking bodies to legislate sin. And now it gets even stranger. See, yeah, up to this point you might have thought, well, you know, what's Hartman? Yeah, it's a good rant, you know. Probably Jesus would be talking about poverty in New Orleans rather than cashless society. But here's where it gets even stranger. This is from Alternet. John Sugg wrote this. Two really devilish guys materialized in Toccoa, Georgia last month to harangue 600 true believers in the gospel of a thoroughly theocratic America, along with lesser lights of the religious right who spoke at America Vision's World View Super Conference 2006. Herb Titus and Gary North called for nothing short of the overthrow of the United States of America. Titus and North aren't household names, but Titus, former dean of TV preacher Pat Robertson's Regent University Law School, has led the legal battle to plant the Ten Commandments in county courthouses across the nation. North, an apostle of the creed called Christian Reconstructionism, is one of the most influential elders of American fundamentalism. He says, I don't want to capture mainstream America's system. I want to replace it. He called for the stoning of gays and non-believers and pointed out that rocks are cheap and plentiful. You get this? The American Taliban is rising right now. I'm telling you, the American Taliban is, they're on their way. The Reconstruction Movement, Judge Roy Moore is out there. He's part of this thing. One-third of the Republicans in Alabama voted in the June primary to support Judge Roy Moore, the American Taliban. South Dakota legislature outlawing abortion, saying, hey, you know, when we get control of the Supreme Court, we get one more Scalia. Or Scalito, and we'll have it. One more Clarence Thomas, one more Scalia, one more Alito. Yeah, that's all we need. The Reconstructionist agenda. And this is the money behind, for example, the company that became the company that became the company that became ES&S that was headed up by Chuck Hagel. They're out there proselytizing the Air Force cadets, future pilots who will have their fingers on the nuclear triggers. Should we be worried, concerned? 16 minutes after the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. And speaking of Jefferson and Madison, let's just look back a little bit. See, the reality is that the times right now, where you've got religious zealots out here saying that their view of the world is the only correct view of the world. Their view of revealed religion is the only correct view of revealed religion. And their view of how things should be done according to their beliefs. That government should become captive of their religion. This is not a new phenomenon in American experience. These guys are trying to recreate American history. They're rewriting textbooks to turn the founders of this country into Bible-thumping fundamentalists. The fact of the matter is, not only were the founders of this country not Bible-thumping fundamentalists, but by and large, they were acting in active opposition to the Bible-thumping fundamentalists who first settled this country. Yes, the Pilgrims were here first, and yes, the Pilgrims were the Bible-thumping fundamentalists. And why did they come here? Because they were fleeing England. Why were they fleeing England? Because they had a revolution there. They deposed the king, Oliver Cromwell, the whole thing, for what, 7 years, I think it was? They ruled the country, and they passed all these religious laws, outlawed, you know, singing and dancing and all. And the people of England said, enough already! And threw out the Puritans. And the Puritans came to Massachusetts, and they were still hanging and burning witches in the early 1700s when Ben Franklin was a young man, and he fled Massachusetts as a result of it, went to Pittsburgh, which was this outpost of secularism. They said, enough already. So what did the founders have to say about this? I mean, the real founders. Well, Ben Franklin, for example, in his autobiographical book, Toward the Mystery, he said, I found Christian dogma unintelligible. Early in life, I absented myself from Christian assemblies. But I would submit to you, you read Franklin's autobiography, he was a thoroughly spiritual man. He just had no use for organized religion. Another founding deist who resisted giving political power to those with religious power was George Washington. Jefferson, in his personal diary entry, February 1, 1799, wrote to himself, when the clergy addressed General Washington on his departure from the government, which must have just happened like, you know, a week before, it was observed in their consultation that he had never on any occasion said a word to the public which showed a belief in the Christian religion. And they thought They should so pen their address as to force him at length to declare publicly whether he was a Christian or not. They did so. However, the old fox was too cunning for them. He answered every article of their address particularly, except that, which he passed over without notice. This is Thomas Jefferson writing in his own diary in February 1799. He goes on to say, Washington never did say a word on the subject of Christianity in any of his public papers, except in his valedictory letter to the governors of the states when he resigned his commission in the army, wherein he speaks of the benign influence of the Christian religion. I know that Governor Morris, who pretends to be in his secrets, in other words, in Washington's confidence, and believes himself to be so, has often told me that George Washington believed no more in fundamental Christian systems than he himself did. End of quote from Thomas Jefferson's personal diary. And in fact, the treaty with Tripoli, which was worked out under George Washington's guidance and signed into law by John Adams in 1797, reads, quote, as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of the Muslimin, and as the said states never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries. In other words, we have no problem with Islam. We're not a theocratic state. We are a secular state. On February 21st, 1811, James Madison, brand new president, been in office about a month. He vetoed a bill passed by Congress that authorized government payments to a church in Washington, D.C. to help the poor. Faith-based initiatives were a clear violation, in his mind, of the doctrine of separation of church and state. In fact, he wrote in his veto message to Congress, quote, because the bill vests and said incorporated church and also authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, this would be a precedent for giving to religious societies as such a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civil duty. In other words, we shouldn't be giving this money to churches. We should be doing this ourselves. This is a public and civic duty. Jefferson, perhaps the most outspoken on this topic, the quote from Jefferson that the Judge Moore crowd loved to promote. I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of man. Yes, Jefferson did say that. It's carved in the roof of the Jefferson Monument. But wait until you hear the context. Who was he talking about when he was talking about the tyrannies imposed upon the mind of men? I'll tell you right after this, and then we'll take your calls as well. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you believe, or you the one to deceive? I'm just trying to find peace while you held up the priest. Coming through, epidemic, can you cure this disease? You're alive on the line, yeah, you know what I mean. Human being, created the gun, aimed at the floods of war. Assembling troops, hiding the truth, we mourn. Never too late to find yourself reborn. Connecting overseas, it's up, where it's born.
So there you have it, my whole life with all those memories. I'm trying to figure out how to set all of my pain free. Sometimes I wish that I could turn the hands of time back so I could rewrite the wrong and put my life back on the right track. Wake up to reality, trying to accept the way it is. They say that life's not what you take, your willingness to give. That's why I wrote this song in hopes to heal the pain within. Cause after that, I know that's when my life truly begins.
All the memories of hate and the lies. Don't you know eventually we'll pay the price?
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Here's the quote. This from Thomas Jefferson that is used by religious right-wingers, and I use the word religious advisedly because I consider myself a Christian and I consider myself a spiritual and arguably even religious person, and I would say that these are people who are actually partisan religious, religiously partisan. The quote from Thomas Jefferson, I have sworn upon the altar of God. Now see, if he says that, he must be a religious guy, right? eternal hostility against every form of tyranny imposed upon the mind of men. Oh, not just religion. He must be using religion to promote democracy. Well, let's look at the letter that he wrote that quote comes from. It was written to Benjamin Rush, who was a Unitarian and a deist, not a Christian. Benjamin Rush was a physician and one of Thomas Jefferson's best friends. This was a letter that was written in absolute confidence, in the belief that it would not be made public. It was written 2 months before the election of 1800, in which Jefferson was running for president. So here you have Thomas Jefferson running for president, and he's being bashed by the people he's running against for not being religious. And he writes this letter to Benjamin Rush. He says, "Dear sir, I promised you a letter on Christianity, which I have not forgotten." He says, "I do not know that it would reconcile the genus irritable vatum," which is Latin for the angry priests, "who are all in arms against me. Their hostility is on too interesting ground to be softened." Then he refers to the First Amendment, which establishes the separation of church and state. He says, "The delusion on the clause of the Constitution, which, while it secured the freedom of the press, covered also freedom of religion, has given to the clergy a very favorable hope of obtaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity throughout the United States. And as every sect believes his own form the true one, everyone perhaps hoped for his own, but especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. The returning good sense of our country," he's speaking of his own election as president, I believe, "the returning good sense of our country threatens abortion to their hopes. And the preachers believe that any portion of power confided in me, such as being elected president, will be exerted in opposition to their schemes. And they believe rightly, for I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. But this is all they have to fear from me. But it is enough, too, in their opinion." You get it? The quote that these guys, they're literally rewriting textbooks to turn Thomas Jefferson into a Bible-thumping Christian when the quote that they're using, he was talking, the tyranny over the mind of man that he was talking about specifically was the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. In another letter talking about a Virginia law he authored, which was the inspiration for the First Amendment, he noted, "where the preamble to the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom," by the way, which he wanted on his tombstone, that he was the author of it, and it's there, "declares that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, an amendment was proposed by inserting the words Jesus Christ, so it should read, a departure from the plan of Jesus Christ, the holy author of our religion. The insertion was rejected by a great majority." He's talking of the people there in the Constitutional Convention, "in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection," that is the Constitution, "the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu, and infidels of every denomination." Another one that Jefferson took on was the idea that that British common law and American law derived from the Ten Commandments. This is another popular myth. And it was a popular myth when he was president. In February 10th, 1814, he wrote a letter to Dr. Thomas Cooper and just took it on, head on. He says, "Finally, in answer to Fortescue Ablin's question, why the Ten Commandments should not now be part of the common law of England, we may say they are not because they never were. Anybody who asserts the Ten Commandments are the basis of American or British law is mistakenly believing a document that is a manifest forgery." Sir Matthew Hale lays it down in these words, wrote Jefferson to Cooper, "Christianity is parcel of the laws of England." But, Jefferson rebuts, it couldn't be. "Just looking at the timeline of English history demonstrates it's impossible." Quoting Jefferson now in his letter to Cooper, "but Christianity was not introduced till the 7th century, the conversion of the first Christian king of the Heptarchy having taken place around the year 598, and that of the last around 686. Here, then, was a space of 200 years, during which the common law was in existence, and Christianity had no part in it." We might as well say that the Newtonian system of philosophy is a part of the common law as that the Christian religion is, wrote Jefferson. In truth, the alliance between church and state in England has ever made their judges accomplices in the frauds of the clergy and even bolder than they are. On January 24, 1814, he wrote a letter to John Adams. He wrote, and I quote, "It is not only the sacred volumes that the churches have thus interpolated, gutted, and falsified, but the works of others relating to them and even the laws of the land. Our judges, too, have lent a ready hand to further these frauds and have been willing to lay the yoke of their own opinions on the necks of others to extend the coercion of municipal law to the dogmas of their religion by declaring that these make a part of the law of the land." John Adams wrote back. This is now John Adams, another president of the United States, another founder. John Adams wrote back to Jefferson in response to that, quote, "Hope springs eternal. 8 millions of Jews hope for a Messiah more powerful and glorious than Moses, David, or Solomon, who is to make them as powerful as he pleases. Some hundreds of millions of Muslims expect another prophet more powerful than Muhammad, who is to spread Islam over the whole earth. Hundreds of millions of Christians expect and hope for a millennium in which Jesus is to reign for 1,000 years over the whole world before it is burnt up. The Hindus expect another and final incarnation of Vishnu, who is to do great and wonderful things, I know not what. But the hope for America? You and I hope for splendid improvements in human society and vast amelioration in the condition of mankind. Our faith," wrote John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, "our faith may be supposed by more rational arguments than any of the former." In other words, we built a secular government. And yet these guys, there is a movement, a very powerful movement in the United States to turn this country into a theocracy, and it is dangerous. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And let's see here, is it Sil in Tampa, Florida? Sil?
Yeah, I had an experience today that I want to relate to everybody. I almost got arrested. I worked for Kerry and put up signs here in Palm Harbor, Florida, and 90% were torn down. I don't know if the police didn't go after them. Nobody turned them in. So there's a congressman named Bill Arrakis. Most people have never heard of him because the guy hasn't done anything. In any event, he's running in the Republican primary. So at the corner of a busy corner of Tampa Road and Highway 19, where my signs were torn down, his sign is there. And where the S is in his name, I put two parallel lines making it into a dollar sign. Okay, with a real thick magic marker.
Right, so you didn't get rid of his sign. You simply...
Well, yeah. Somebody at the gas station decided to turn me in.
Yeah.
And so about an hour and a half later, I get a knock at the door, and there's two cops at the door.
Holy cow.
And I'm thinking, oh, what the hell? I mean, why would they be here? And I knew, and I said, well, I know I don't have any smoke here, so... So in any event... I almost got busted. They read me my rights.
Amazing.
And they called up the congressman's office, and apparently he was in. They called someone called him up, and then the congressman's office called the police. I don't know it was,
yeah.
But you know, they let me sweat it out, and they went and called the guy up, and they let me off. But you know, I thought I was going to get handcuffed, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get myself out of this? So I just want to warn people. At least if you're in Florida, that you can get busted for taking down a sign or altering a sign, as I did.
Unless it's a Democrat sign.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, you know, I've certainly seen that over and over again. I mean, it's amazing. So thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's that's a funny one. Shall America become a theocracy? Should America become a theocracy? Is it possible that America could become a theocracy? I mean, you got Jerry Falwell out there saying...
Most people, many pay their bills online already. And the day will come, I believe, when there will be no cash.
Yeah. It's coming. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When you're so down hearted and misunderstood, just over and over and over you go.
Yeah. You know, the Republicans are already circling the wagons in Iowa for the 2007 and 2008, you know, ginning up for the 2008 election for the primaries and all that kind of stuff. The Iowa caucuses, they won't be held for 17 months. But Republicans are showing up there. John McCain and, you know, all these. On it goes. The Republican platform in Iowa. The Republican platform in Iowa specifically says that abortion should be outlawed. Specifically says that teachers should be leading prayers in school. Specifically says that the government should compensate health care providers, but citizens who cannot afford private health insurance should receive at public expense only emergency life-saving care. It objects to government assistance to families for the loss of an individual one due to an act of God. That's a verbatim quote. In other words, if God kills you, you're on your own. Teachers and principals should be free to physically punish school children. Abolish the U.S. Department of Education. Conduct executions, teacher-led prayer in school, display of the Ten Commandments, and use, and I'm quoting from the Republican platform in Iowa, use of the Bible as a textbook. Educators, I'm quoting again from the Republican platform in Iowa, educators would teach alternative theories on the origins of life, including Darwinian evolution, creation science, and intelligent design, each given equal weight in presentation. And the concept of separation of church and state will be a thing of the past. And you wonder, you know, could it happen here? Matt in Sacramento, California. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out in the Virginia Declaration of Rights, I believe Mason wrote most of them, which was a month before the Declaration of Independence. The last article in it says that we are to treat each, it is the duty of people to treat each other with, quote, Christian forbearance, love, and charity. And if you define Christianity as forbearance, love, and charity, I think we are a Christian country, and it's only when you bastardize it like Bush has done that it becomes something else.
Yeah, good point. And George Mason was
a
Christian.
And I'm a Christian like you, and we just got to stick to, we got to not allow them to take our religion.
There you go. Well said. I got it, Matt. Thanks very much. Dorothy in British Columbia. Hey, Dorothy.
Hi, Tom. Finally, I've been trying to call you, you know, over and over again over the last couple of years, I think. Anyway.
I'm glad you made it through.
Yeah. I'm from British Columbia. I live on an island, and I'm connected to the Internet. CBC carried a story yesterday morning and never repeated it, and it's about the Presbyterian Church publishing a 9/11 conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
Calling, and here's a quote, I found a story on the Malaysia Sun today, the book's title is Christian Faith and the Truth About 9/11, A Call to Reflection and Action. Author David Ray Griffin called the United States the world's chief embodiment of demonic power.
Oh, my goodness.
I thought that's quite a story.
He's been a guest on this program a couple of times. He's one of the leading of the so-called conspiracy theorists who's raising, I think, frankly, some very good questions about 9/11. Dorothy, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. Joyce in Tip City, Ohio. Hey, Joyce.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you about a local public elementary school around here that I heard had posters up in at least a few of the classrooms and the principal's office that were a big flag background, and it said, "In God We Trust," in real big letters on the poster, and then underneath it said the national motto of the United States adopted by Congress in 1956 in tiny little letters. And I looked for it on the Internet, and I found out it's a campaign by the American Family Association.
What a surprise.
I know.
The theocrats are rising, and they're trying to infiltrate our schools if you can get them young, right?
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought. I don't want my you know, you would hope or you would wish that it would, you know, that your kids would be able to avoid that kind of thing, and their little elementary school kids, you know.
Yeah, they really shouldn't be caught in the crossfire of a bunch of theocrats trying to take over a government. That religion should most appropriately be kept in mosques and synagogues and churches. I mean, you know, it's just so basic and fundamental. Chris in Seattle, Washington. Thank you for the call, by the way. Chris in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Chris.
Hey, man, I can't tell you how amazing you are. I'm hooked. I've only listened to you a couple times, but I'm hooked. I'm so amazed at what you just explained right now. I don't understand why it's not, more explained.
Everything that I shared with you, you know, a few of the details, I suppose, I've come across more recently, but pretty much everything I shared with you is what I was learning in public schools in the late 50s and early 60s. They're just not teaching this stuff anymore.
I graduated in 99, and, you know, I was, up until right now, I really believed that Christian, that this country was founded on Christian values and that it was, you know, adopted in the beginning.
A lot of the founders were Christians, certainly, although they were Protestant Christians.
Well, yeah.
They hated the Catholics. they were anti-Semitic. I mean, you know, you go right on down the list. They have very specific form of Protestantism. But, they did not mean for this country to be a religious institution. It was, in fact, they were, the founding of this country in large part was not just blowback against England. It was also blowback against Massachusetts, against the Puritans in Massachusetts. In fact, Massachusetts, one of the big crises of Jefferson's administration in around 1802, 1803, was Massachusetts almost seceded from the Union. Massachusetts was talking about pulling away because the country wasn't becoming religious enough, and they wanted to go back to burning witches at the stake. Well, the guys who want to burn witches at the stake, they're back. They called Falwell and Robertson and Bush and Frist and the whole bunch of them. It's just a downright spooky thing, and we just need to, I think, frankly, educate people about it, wake people up and say, you know, if any government gives into any religion, then it's no longer government, it's a theocracy, and that's just not a healthy thing. We'll see you tomorrow, my friends. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.